Looking for jewelry that feels as good as it looks? Jenny Bird delivers modern designs that are comfortable, easy to wear, and effortlessly versatile. Every piece makes you feel instantly on trend without trying too hard. Need to send a gift they'll be sure to love? Jenny Bird ships fast, and the packaging is thoughtful too. Jenny Bird isn't just jewelry. It's your new favorite style essential. Explore more at jenny-bird.com and get 20% off your first purchase using code ONTREND20.
Welcome in to episode one of Punt and the Poor Man. Drew Butler alongside my good buddy Ryan Skates, the founder, the publisher, the editor, the CEO, the chairman of the board of the Poor Man's Game Notes. Welcome, Ryan. Things.
Gosh, it's a heavy burden to bear.
Yes.
And I'm glad that somebody's finally recognizing all the hard work that goes into it. But how exciting is this?
Yeah, it's great. The impetus for this podcast is, one, Punt and Pass now is about to go into its seventh season, Ryan. And Poor Man's Game Notes is in its
12th
edition. Fantastic.
Welcome to the game.
Yes, absolutely. Some would say newsletters are the new thing. You've been doing that for a long time. Others would say podcasts are still the new thing. But hey, been doing this for a while. Why Punt and the Poor Man? Well, everybody was always asking for some consistent content from Punt and Pass in years past. You obviously take a hiatus from Punt and the Poor Man as well when it's not football season. You and I have done some podcasts together in the past. They do strikingly well. People said, Drew, Ryan, you guys should do an interview series. You came to me and said, let's do an interview series. I said, okay. You said, let's start a podcast. I go, well, instead of starting a podcast, let's do a series in the Punt and Pass umbrella. Thus, Punt and the Poor Man has begun. It is the convergence of the spoken word of Punt and Pass and the written word of the Poor Man's Game Nuts.
It's the word.
Yes, it is the word, okay? And it is the collaboration you never knew you needed but always wanted. Here we are.
Oh, man, the intimacy here, the eye contact.
Yes.
I have to stop.
I'm making it uncomfortable. I am making it uncomfortable. Our first guest is none other than Lauren Smith. And why Lauren Smith, right? Could we have gotten anybody else? Well, of course we could, but we had to start with Lauren because to know Lauren is to know the University of Georgia. And the Punt and the Poor Man, to start, we'll have a little bit of a Georgia focus, but we're going to branch out. We've got a murderer's row of awesome guests who are going to come on. We'll have episodes for you all through the spring and summer. But Georgia is not what it is today without Lauren Smith. He is the Georgia Athletics Historian. He's had a 50-plus year broadcasting career here at the university. He's an author. He's a writer. Ryan, he's had 5 books, or I think more, published by Augusta National Golf Club.
It's wild, all the things he's done. And so many of them, as he talks about in the interview, are things he just kind of thought he wanted to be a part of. Like,
yeah.
You know, he went to the Masters for the first time. He's like, I got to figure out a way to keep doing this. And now he's in the Masters, you know, Media Hall of Fame. I'm butchering the actual title for that. I hope I don't get struck by lightning. But, I mean, how great is that? I mean, and he is a Georgia institution.
Yes.
You know, he is something that, if you know about Lauren Smith, you're a real one, right? So you know what it means to be a Bulldog,
yeah,
at least. Where if you're just tuning into ESPN and you see the Dogs playing, you wouldn't necessarily know about him, but I mean, he has a wealth of information about UGA. He's a true treasure. He is one of a breed that we're seeing less of,
yeah,
sadly,
yeah,
and it is pretty heady stuff to get to share a room with him and ask him some questions.
No doubt. We were very thankful for his time and talking about kind of the heady nature of us being in here before we taped. You and I were doing some prep, the little prep that we did. And there was a picture of, you know, you could call it Georgia's Mount Rushmore, albeit it was 5 people, and it was Larry Munson, Vince Dooley, Irk Russell, Dan McGill, and Lauren Smith. And Lauren's the only one left standing, right? Yeah. He talked about his relationship with Coach Dooley. He talked about his relationship with Larry Munson, Dan McGill, who a lot of people around Georgia know the name of, but he kind of describes the person that he was, and he's got some phenomenal stories that we're going to get into in this interview.
I like how, you know, my favorite thing that you brought up was the idea of him and Dan McGill sitting outside of what's now Five Points Bottle Shop holding court. And then he knew exactly what we were talking about and was like, well, Coach McGill would drink three Budweisers, and I just drank one Miller Light. It's like, oh, man, I want, who knows what was said to passersby outside of whatever restaurant that was at the time. But what a scene.
Absolutely. We hope you enjoy this awesome interview with our first guest right here on Punt and the Poor Man. It is Lauren Smith. Please enjoy. Okay, folks, episode one of Punt and the Poor Man. We are here in Athens, Georgia, inside the Carmichael Sport Media Institute, Grady College of Journalism. And I am thrilled to introduce our first guest ever. It is none other than Lauren Smith, an absolute legend around Georgia and the University of Georgia Athletic Association. A Georgia athletics historian, a 50-plus year Georgia broadcaster, an author, a writer, all things Georgia Bulldogs. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today, sir?
Great. Good to be with you guys, and thanks for inviting me.
No doubt. So the impetus for this interview series is to kind of branch out past just game previews, game reviews, general talk around Georgia football and the SEC, and get to know the figures that make this great sport and this great institution what it is. So we figured, let's go ahead and start with Lauren. And I guess the first question would be, could you have ever imagined Georgia football reaching the sustained success that they are currently experiencing? We were just talking before we taped. You were out in Los Angeles. Obviously, you were in Indianapolis last year, back-to-back national champions. It's quite a time to be a Georgia Bulldog.
No question about it, Drew. I think the interesting thing about all this is that I've become exposed to college football all across the country for a long period of time, principally the SEC, but I've looked at other programs. I've gotten to know all of the great names, and I'm making a point when I say this. In college football coaching, I knew Woody Hayes, I knew Bo Schembechler, I knew Bud Wilkinson, Barry Switzer, Tom Osborne, and Bob Devaney.
Wow.
At Nebraska, and just John McKay at Southern Cal, and got to know those people by having just a slight exposure. But Enterprise got in there in the mix, and I looked these guys up. I never did work for them, but I listened to them lecture. If they were lecturing at a coaching clinic, I sat in on the lectures. Mm-hmm. I'd never drawn up a play in my life, and there's a lot about football I don't know. I'm not an X's and O's guy. But as I kid my friend Davey Pollock, you don't have to be an actor to be a theater critic.
Yeah.
So
very true.
So you don't have to have an acting credential. You don't have to be a member of the guild. But I'm making a point to say that football for so long was provincial. It was regional. Now it's national. And it didn't take me long in his first year to realize that Kirby Smart was special. And he is the reason we are now, in my opinion, for the first time in our history, fulfilling our potential and fulfilling on a sustained basis.
Yeah.
So all the credit goes to Kirby, and I think he's the kind of guy that won't let it ever turn his head, because he knows it's almost fatal to think you're pretty good in sport in any way, and that certainly certainly includes coaching. But every school thinks that it ought to be contending and ought to be great, but only such a few will ever attain that kind of success. I have a lot of Ole Miss friends, including Archie Manning.
Yeah.
They feel that they can be like they were in the vault years, but that might be a little hard. And they should dominate the state because they are the state university, and that means they have the constituency that really is passionate, not to take anything away from a Mississippi State or Mississippi Southern fan. But I don't think it will ever be at Ole Miss what it was, or it's going to be tough to be at Ole Miss.
Certainly.
What was there when Johnny Vaught coached. Now, that may not be the best analogy of Ole Miss's situation. I'm not taking the passion out of the mix. So somebody might come along and find a way to make it to what it was in the vault years. I don't think that some schools who have ambition will ever make it. But I was by to see Clay Helton at Georgia Southern recently. What a nice guy doing a terrific job. And he sees the 12-team playoff as a plus for college football because he can see where in a given year Georgia Southern might get into a 12-team playoff.
No question.
No chance of them ever getting into a 4-team playoff. So I'm sort of rambling, but I just feel like Georgia has always had more potential than it had success. And that's not a knock on anybody. Because winning, I don't care what level you're in or on, it's hard. It's just hard to win, especially to win a championship.
No doubt.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think one thing that was so hard for Georgia fans was that we saw that we had this amazing culture. We had the most loyal fans stick with Georgia through some dark days in the 90s. And it was Georgia's culture was attractive not only to Georgia fans, but to everybody across the SEC. And you were a huge part of that. And I want to say thank you for letting us call that ours. The rapport you had with Larry Munson is a core memory I have, you know, riding in the car on a Saturday with my dad and hearing you guys go back and forth. We weren't Georgia fans, but we would not miss a Georgia radio broadcast to hear you and him go back and forth and talk about Georgia football, which at that time was kind of provincial. But that's something that's so dear to so many Georgia fans. So I just want to say thank you for letting us have that. It's something that we feel great pride in. And, I mean, you've been such a huge part of what it means to be a Bulldog. So I know that's not lost on you, but I feel like it would be remiss to not bring it up.
Well, you're mighty nice. It was something that just happened. I don't know that I could ever take credit for anything. I did have the passion, did have the interest, and I wanted to see Georgia do well. And I was influenced by the greatest dog ever, Dan McGill. He's legendary among those who are a little younger than you guys. Kevin's Bruce dad knew about Dan McGill. But I think that it just was something that happened, and Munson was unique. Larry, I've always described as being someone. He's like that center fielder who could run with the wind. He could hit for average and power, and not really know why. Munson just had a gift for radio. He grew up in Minnesota, loving sports, and just saw an ad. Somebody was looking for a sports director or maybe just an announcer, and he got a job maybe in the Dakotas by just answering an ad. And then he went to Wyoming, and Kurt Gowdy was at Wyoming, and he told him, look, if you're ever going to make it big, you got to go get a minor league baseball job and work your way up, because the big deal with announcers back then was to try to get a big league job in baseball. That was the ultimate. And Gowdy, as you know, went on to work with the Yankees, work with Mel Allen, and then he got the Red Sox job, and that was his core position. So it was wonderful, and the timing was extraordinary in that television hadn't really come about.
Mm-hmm.
Vin Scully was someone I got to know, which was a delightful, fun experience, and I've read about it and I've talked to people. When he went to L.A., when the Dodgers moved to L.A. in the 50s, it was sort of the only game in town. Television wasn't really big on mm-hmm. the West Coast then. It might have been for something like Johnny Carson, although that was ahead of his time. I mean, he came to L.A. later, but I heard people talk about the Dodgers would be playing, and it's Ben Scully's all you had. You didn't have Yeah, Sports Center.
Of course.
You didn't have any of the television networks covering baseball in Southern California. So he was the only voice. And I've heard people talk about who lived out there and lived in the nice, cozy neighborhoods, which there were a lot of those in Los Angeles and still are some places today. But you could walk down the street and you could hear Vin from house to house to house.
Wow, yeah.
You know? So Munson was a little bit that way. In 1980, when we won the national championship, Vince's national championship season, his national championship year, we weren't on TV until the eighth game, seventh or eighth, South Carolina. I forgot now.
Wow. That
was seventh or eighth game. So Munson was it. And I remember we beat Kentucky on Rex Robinson's kick. And then next Monday, the Monday following, Vince spoke to the Atlanta Touchdown Club, and I drove him over. I don't know why I did. But for some reason, I made the trip over, and I volunteered to drive him. So I got stopped for speeding in Conyers, and I got out of the car. In those days, you know, it was probably smart to get out of your car and greet the officer and tell him you no good, so-and-so. But anyway, this cop, I said, well, he said, what you in such a big hurry for? I said, well, we were late to get to the touchdown club meeting, and Coach Dooley, I'm driving him over. He's speaking today. He says, oh, boy, wasn't that a great game? Says, that Munson something, isn't he? So I always appreciate Munson getting me out of a speeding
there
ticket.
Something that came through on your broadcasts with him, and, you know, maybe I'm picking up on something that's not there, maybe I am, but you seemed to have a great friendship together. I mean, and to the point where you might even get annoyed with each other in a high stress part of the game. I remember there's one game where it's a crucial third down or something, and Munson goes down to you, and you're like, what do you got, Lauren? And you're like, I'm here with Charles Grant, and he's just telling me how much he loves boiled peanuts. And Munson, you can tell, is just disgusted. He's like, all right, you know, and he cuts you off. And that was just gold. And, you know, I would love to hear more about maybe the friendship behind that, where y'all were comfortable enough kind of being curt with each other in front of all of us.
Well, you know, we never did really do anything much beyond the games. He had his family, and I had mine. He had a full-time job with a radio station in Atlanta until he got the job at WSB doing drive time. And so we never did spend any time together. We did fish once or twice. So it wasn't the absence of a rapport. It didn't go beyond the games too much. And fishing with him, though, was quite an experience. You know, he talked in that same vernacular he did a game. Oh, that north wind. I don't like it driving those fish down 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 feet.
That's amazing.
And it was really great. And I wrote a column about that for the Atlanta Journal and talking about him and how he appreciated his memories of his daddy who took him fishing. So he loved to fish, he loved to hunt. But then when he got to Atlanta, you know, he first came with the Braves, and that didn't last forever. Then he went back to Nashville, and he was working the 6 o'clock news as a newscaster. He might have done sports too, I don't remember. And so he was driving in and doing the games, come in Friday night, work the Georgia game, then drive home to Nashville after the game. And I once wrote that he met more state troopers than he did Georgia fans. So he didn't really become entrenched with the Georgia people until he came back to Atlanta and started working with the Georgia news network, I think it. Well, it's a Georgia network, I believe, put together by a guy named Officer Don. You remember him on the kiddie shows, cartoon shows?
Officer Don?
Officer Don.
No, I don't remember
he
that.
He owned the network.
Okay.
State network. Well, the stations in Waycross, Valdosta, you know, up north, Dalton, they didn't have any way of covering the state news, state capitals, legislatures in session. So he had the idea of providing supplements. You know, he had somebody covered the Capitol, somebody covered sports. And Munson did everything. He did what news, weather, sport, came in early in the morning, made the coffee, swept out the stock room. He did it all. And so his work ethic was remarkable. And then it wasn't a high-paying job. So he'd finish in the afternoon, drive somewhere like Vidalia, take him 2 hours, a half, 3 hours to get there, make a speech, then drive back home. Then he was up at 4:30 in the morning, 5. So Munson was a rare guy. A lot of people didn't know about that side of him.
Yeah.
And then he developed a great following that became so entrenched. And he developed that downcast routine. I've seen him, somebody walk up to him in a hotel, we're checking in, a road game.
Mm-hmm.
Walk up and say, "Hey, what about whomever we play, Auburn, what about Tennessee?" He said, "Oh, God, have you seen their tackles? Biggest tackles. They're bigger than those guys in the NFL." So he'd go into we ain't got a chance routine right there in the hotel lobby.
It's remarkable. You know, I watched you honor Coach Dooley last year at the Jimmy Rain Foundation ceremony in Montgomery, Alabama, and you brought up Larry a lot in that induction for Coach Dooley. And it almost seemed like you kind of played the mediator between Larry and Coach Dooley because, as you just said, his pessimistic nature never was good enough, never was going to be a good game for the Georgia Bulldogs. What was their relationship like, Coach Dooley and Larry Munson, and how did you play in the middle of that?
I don't really think I had a role of any kind, but I do remember Vince saying that Larry made him look like an optimist, so... that was fairly true. I think Larry became his shtick, we say.
Yeah.
So he stuck to it, and people sort of enjoyed it. And but he and Vince, I think they fished a time or two.
Did they?
And they had, when you're in football full time, really into it as a coach and as an announcer, as Larry was. You don't really have time to socialize all that much. You get into a routine, and then in the off season, though, there was a little time to do things. And Vince appreciated Larry because the Georgia fans appreciated him so much. I can remember that Vince got really upset when Larry was unable to do the Sugar Bowl. You know, in 1980, when we won the national championship, Georgia broadcast crew could not.
Is that right?
We couldn't do the Sugar Bowl.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Well, the reason we couldn't was that ABC had the network rights, and so they had their broadcast. Mm-hmm. They had Keith Jackson did TV. I've forgotten who did radio. But there was a moratorium against, and so Vince and I both went to work, and he had a little bit more of a heavyweight opportunity to, and we finally went to the bowl and said, "Look, just tell ABC, you want to let the two competing teams, at least let them bring their announcer and do the game."
Yeah.
And I tell you how bad it was. This WRFC was the Georgia station forever and ever and ever. We played in the Sugar Bowl, there's a station here in town. I've forgotten who the ABC affiliate was. It wasn't WGAU. They were CBS. But they did the game. Here's WRC. They had the Bulldogs all year, and now they can't do the bowl game.
Wow.
So it was sort of messy there for a while. But Vince went to bat, and he had a great influence. And finally, the bowls did agree that the two competing teams' announced crew could do the games. But Munson didn't do the bowl in 1980. Didn't even go to New Orleans, as I recall.
I want to get your next question, but I have a trivia question for both of you. Obviously, Munson's most famous call was Run, Lindsey, Run, right? 1980 Georgia versus Florida. Do you know who did the TV call of that game? The broadcaster?
Al Michaels.
Yes, sir. Al Michaels. Nobody's ever heard Al Michaels call Run, Lindsey, Run, but it's remarkable because that's how impactful Larry Munson was.
I mean, what did Al Michaels say there? He was probably like, "Oh, there goes the Georgia receiver.
Yeah.
That's a touchdown for Georgia.
Absolutely.
Looks like Georgia's going to win."
Not a lot of passion there from Al, but no question. Great answer. I knew Lauren would have the answer to that one.
This is going to be kind of a wonky question, but you have kind of gotten to sports media rights there as you were talking about, you know, we couldn't bring our own, or Georgia couldn't bring their own radio team to the Sugar Bowl at that time. And you were around during the time that there was the University of Georgia and Oklahoma sued the NCAA to be able to sell their own media rights. Do you, what do you remember from that time? Were you involved with, you know, any of the strategy or thinking behind that? Obviously, it was a UGA law professor. I forget his name, who was a lawyer on that. But that's one of the first cases.
Was the dean of the law school, and he talked Fred Davison into challenging the NCAA. I didn't have anything to do with it. Naturally, I wasn't high enough in the administration. I might have had an opinion if somebody wanted it, but they were going to go with Vince and what his opinion was. It was... it sort of broke it open, and I guess that was good. But now some people didn't like two things. They didn't like upsetting the apple cart. The other was they didn't understand why Georgia got in bed with Oklahoma. They could have chosen another partner. That was criticism in some circles in the SEC. I remember Fred Russell, the grand old sports columnist for the Nashville Banner, asked me, "What the hell are you doing?" So I think that it probably turned out to be good because it brought us to where we are today. I mean, if you want to watch football starting at daybreak in the fall now, you can.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It goes to midnight. And so everybody's team is playing, and it's just enhanced, I think, college football and people – find a way to see their team every Saturday somehow or other. I think if you're a Georgia fan living in Los Angeles or Seattle, you're going to be able to get the Georgia game in some shape or form. And now you can damn near get everything, including basketball, volleyball, track.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So the proliferation of television has really helped the colleges.
So, you know, Coach Dooley and University of Georgia were at the crossroads of two of maybe the most influential things that have now brought us to where we are. So that would be one, the NCAA lawsuit that allowed schools to do their own media rights deals. And then the second would be the collegiate licensing company and the idea to license your own intellectual property to be sold on and control who can buy your gear and things like that. So coming from those two things, which seem almost quaint now to this world of transfer portals and NIL, I mean, is this the same game? Do you recognize the game today versus what it was when you first started at Georgia?
Oh, no. When I came along, it was slow and lethargic. Now it's a greyhound kind of game. Every athlete, there's some remarkable athletes out there now. They can really perform, and I think it's great for them that we have what we do have. However, it's like having an undisciplined student in your class and don't let him ruin the whole class. I think that there should be some sort of controls on where we are. Otherwise, we're going to ruin the game. Now, I haven't talked to Todd Monken, but I'll bet you when he lit out for Baltimore, he probably told his wife, Terry, "I won't ever have to answer another question about NIL." I know that went through his mind.
I don't doubt that at all. I don't doubt that at all. You speak about the Greyhounds and the elite athletes and just how much bigger and faster the game of college football is. I've got to ask you, you got a front row look at how big these athletes were a couple of years ago when you got knocked down in the indoor facility and you broke your hip. You were at age 80. And you're still hanging with us now today. I just walked you up 15 flights of stairs. How did that go down? You okay? You feeling good? How's the hip feeling?
I took the elevator. You took the stairs? I took the elevator up here.
Well, I did okay. I didn't think anything about it. I didn't like the idea of it, my leg being broken. But I'll tell you a little story about that. I was back at work in 4 days.
I know.
It didn't really bother me. I didn't have any pain. But now, I had hernia surgery back this past summer, summer of 2022.
Yeah.
And God, I felt awful for 3 months. I mean, it was an outpatient thing. I had the surgery one morning, came home, spent the rest of the day in bed, but I got up the next day and began to try to make it business as usual, but it was hard. And then it just was irritating, and it just led to great frustration. And then I felt it robbed me of my efficiency of getting things done. But I had gone down to tell John Parker, a good friend, that we ought to get a drink after practice, get a beer. And I saw there's a little out route was the play before the one I got hit. I got hit, and I said, John, we better move down here. So we moved several yards down the field. But the next drill was a punt return, and so he's coming up. And finally he ran into and hit John, knocked John into me, and then I hit the turf, and my leg was broken. My hip was broken. And
those damn punters. They could never do it right.
Hey, how about John Parker, though, breaking the fall a little bit?
John Parker breaking the fall.
Gave you a commemorative Coca-Cola bottle when that was over, I'm sure.
And then, John, the day of my surgery, I had me up walking, and I slept a little while, and John came into the hospital, and he snuck in a bottle of Camus.
Okay, now we're talking.
And so I had a social hour.
There you go.
I hadn't missed one since.
Good for you. Well, we're glad you're still here.
He's absolutely an all-time great.
You mentioned Coach McGill a little bit earlier. I want you to give our audience a little bit of background of who Coach McGill was, how important he's been to the University of Georgia and still is to the University of Georgia. And then in doing some research before this interview, I had some people tell me that you and Coach McGill used to frequent an establishment in Five Points and maybe hung outside until the wee hours of the night, telling stories and making sure that everybody was okay in the streets of Athens.
Well, it didn't last that long because he was middle age then, you know, in his 50s and then 60s, and so he didn't last that long. But we would stay a couple hours, and he drank 3 Budweisers to my 1, and I was drinking Miller Lite. He's drinking Budweiser, his favorite. And he just was a great raconteur, and he had time for people. And he had a marvelous memory and a marvelous exposure. And he was a multifaceted, multi-talented guy who really, truly loved Georgia in the greatest sense. I've never known anyone before, and I don't think there'll ever be anybody who truly loved Dan in a pure love relationship. Now, he believed that he could have been successful in business. He felt like he could write sports on a national level. He felt like he could probably have gotten into politics. He certainly would have been a good speaker from the stump. But he didn't want to do any of that. He wanted to be in Athens promoting the University of Georgia. So he wasn't restricted to tennis, his number one sport. He became the winningest tennis coach in history. Later, his record was broken by a guy at Stanford who was a good friend of his. So nobody loved Georgia more than Dan McGill, and I talked to former Lieutenant Governor Pierre Howard about him yesterday, because Pierre and I talk occasionally, and every time we talk about how great Dan McGill was. Yeah. He just keeps on going, because that's the way we truly feel, and that's why we appreciated him so much. He was a historian, and he promoted Georgia, all sports. He had been the prep editor of the Atlanta Journal back in the days when that was big. Preps were so big. Created the high school all-star game. Just was a marvelous individual. And his motivation was to promote Georgia. So he would promote anybody. Somebody, I guess it's a guy who's singing in Carnegie Hall. And Dan knew about that. Dan used to take the train to New York and go out to Flushing Meadow, where the U.S. Tennis Championships were held at the time. He went to see being an Irishman, he was a big fan of Billy Kahn, who was a lightweight, but he almost beat Joe Louis, a heavyweight,
wow.
and had him beat on points. And Dan saw the fight, and he could imitate Billy Kahn, you know, the Irishman's jabs. And the reason he didn't win is he tried to knock Joe Louis out, and then Joe Louis hit him with a jawbreaker and knocked him out. So Dan just had a great love for sports and just a great love for people, and he was a great humorist.
Talking about range of sports and being involved with a lot of different sports, I had a cool opportunity to tour the media center at Augusta National, which is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they have like a wall of fame, you know, with names written in gold lettering. And right up there at the top is Lawrence Smith. And I understand, you know, you've been to what, 40 in a row open championships, and you've been covering Masters for a long time, and even have contributed to the annuals that they write about each tournament at the end of the year. So could you tell us about how you got involved writing about golf and that whole
scene? Geography can do a lot for a country boy. If I had been born in Arkansas, I'd have never been able to drive down to Augusta in 2 hours. And also, I think about the fact that I didn't do it for years, but now I get a little bit frustrated if I don't go to baseball spring training. Well, that's 5 hours away, so geography has opened a lot of doors for me. But I went over to see the 1960 Masters when Arnold Palmer won his second Masters by birdieing the 17th and the 18th holes. And my friend Kerry Williamson, who owns the Greensboro Journal-Herald, had two tickets. And he took me on Sunday, and we stood right behind the 18th green, and I watched Arnold Palmer come up, and I thought this was the most beautiful place I've ever been in my life, and it's only 2 hours from that farm where I grew up, and I didn't know anything about it. Quite frankly, golf was elite. It wasn't as elite as some people made it out to be, but if you grow up in austere circumstances, and that was the way it was for so many kids across the state of Georgia, you couldn't own clubs, let alone going to a country club. That was unthinkable. So, I know when I joined the Athens Country Club, I thought about the austere life that I enjoyed in Middle Georgia on a farm, and I sort of sat down and had a few tears. You know, here I am, a member of the Athens Country Club. I thought that was one of the greatest milestones of my life. But after going over with Kerry, I decided, this is pretty good. I'm going to make a habit of this if I can. So I set about getting a press credential for the Athens Banner-Herald. And I wrote, and I got accredited right off the bat. And it wasn't that difficult back then. It wasn't the demands of today. And I went over and covered the Masters by writing my columns after the round was completed, and we had we were an afternoon paper, so I had to have it into the paper, typewritten, went to Linotype, cold type, you know, and then I had to get it in by 8 o'clock in the morning, but I figured out if I got my column done, put it in an envelope, and buy a 35-cent special delivery stamp, it would get from Augusta to Athens by 7 o'clock the next morning. So I couldn't pay for Western Union, or the paper sure wasn't going to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I started covering the Masters in that fashion, and I haven't missed a Masters since 1960.
Wow. Amazing, amazing. And across the pond, the Open Championship. How many in a row? I think you missed one. Did you miss the COVID year? But other than that, it's got to be 40-plus in a row, right?
Well, I didn't continue. My wife traveled with me for years. She doesn't want to go anymore. She's said she's been enough to Europe. And then it's so blessed expensive now. I go as a freelancer. I might get lucky and get a frequent flyer connection. I've done that a time or two, but it was just difficult But the byproduct of all that was I got to meet so many people, and I have French friends, I have English and Scottish friends that whenever I go back, I usually visit with them. But I'm afraid my days at the Open are over.
What's your favorite course on the Open Rota, or one that you've covered?
Well, I love Muirfield. That's Zach Nicklaus's favorite course, but St. Andrews.
Yeah.
St. Andrews is so unique, and I just enjoy it so much. The people, the caddies. Herbert Warren Wynn, a great writer for the New Yorker magazine, said to play golf in Scotland and not use a caddy is to deny oneself the wine of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Great statement.
Yeah.
And Bud Wilkinson, I don't know if y'all have ever researched anything about him, but he stood about 6'2", and he had a nice, flowing, fluid swing. He was a good athlete. He was All-American under Bernie Bierman at Minnesota. But he was playing St. Andrews with his good friend Duffy Daugherty, and there's a play at the backside. And you've probably played it, I know.
Drew. I haven't been over there. Have you been over there?
I haven't.
Yeah, you're talking to two novices.
It's called the loop. You know, three holes are sort of configured where it has a loop effect, and there's a par three there, and Bud walked up on the tee, and those caddies, they don't mince words. Bud says, he looked at the shot and says, give me the four iron. The caddy says, it's a three iron, sir. And Bud looked at it and said, no, I think I can get there with the four. And the caddy kept on, it's a three iron, sir. So finally, Bud made one final look, said, give me the three iron. I mean, give me the four iron. And the caddy says, you may be getting it from me.
I'm not going to give it to you. Go get it yourself. Yeah, I mean, that's brilliant. Did he hit the green? Did he go with the four? Do you know?
I don't remember the outcome. I just remember the repartee on the tee with the
amazing
caddy. Those caddies are really something. The first time I played St. Andrews, I played with a caddy named Sidney Rutherford, who was 82 years old.
No way.
He had played 18 holes that morning, and he was my caddy in the afternoon, had on a flannel shirt with a tie.
That's great. That's amazing. Bringing things back to football before we get into our last segment, which is aptly titled Five to Go. What similarities do you see between Coach Dooley and Kirby Smart? Obviously, now you've been around with both of the head coaches that have brought national championships to Georgia, and it seems like their leadership style and their coaching style somewhat mirror each other in some aspects.
Well, first of all, they're very smart. I tell everybody, Kirby, one of the smartest people I've ever been around, his surname defines him. And I don't know that you can compare eras quite like I just don't know if it was so different in Vince's time. It was tough to win a championship, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't recruit as dominantly as Kirby seems to do every year. That sort of sets Kirby apart. But Vince had a great team in the group he recruited with Herschel. That was his best recruiting years. Then he had those 3 years, 80, 81, and 2. Those 3 years, they were pretty dominant.
Yeah.
I didn't win but one national championship, but he was in a position he might have won three. Mm-hmm. If he could have won them all in 82, 81, 2, but we lost 2 and 3. So they're very, very conscious of the fundamentals of football. They both were. Vince was, and Kirby is,
mm-hmm.
To get it in the proper tense. And so they're very similar, and you don't beat yourself. I mean, Vince didn't lose a game against a team he was supposed to win mm-hmm. very often. And they love the kicking game. Kirby don't talk about it a lot, but he mm-hmm. thinks kicking is. I mean, he knows the value of the kicking game. But it was a little different back then in Vince's time. The game was slower. it's so fast now. Oh my gosh. I tell people this and they just shake their heads. Somebody's asking me back during the fall, says, they happen to see a little sheet I have that comes out every week, which Steve Cockwood did for years, about what all of our pro players did on Sunday. You'll see that, I'm sure, during the fall. And you see Jordan Davis on special teams. Yeah. And he's 335 pounds. And then you figure, well, he was clocked, running 20.3 miles per hour.
Yeah. Just unbelievable.
So there wasn't any athletes like that in Vince's day.
No, not in the world.
Very few today.
Yeah. That is a fact for sure. No, you're right though. It's remarkable. It's remarkable what Kirby's been able to build, the sustained success that we started off this conversation with, and how there are a lot of similarities to Coach Dooley, and obviously the impact Coach Dooley had not only on Georgia football but on the athletic department as a whole as an athletic director. And we obviously miss him, and we wish their family and Miss Barber the best.
Something I wanted to ask you about, and I'm coming from a total place of ignorance here, and have no background on it, but driving into town, going down Prince Avenue, I've noticed that the Cancer Center, Piedmont Hospital, or the old Athens Regional, is named the Lawrence Smith Cancer Center. I want to know if that's you, first off, and then two, if you could tell us maybe about how that came to be.
Well, it is I. I tried to get them not to do that because I couldn't give them any money. I said, give it to a family who's had a cancer experience and that's got some money that can help you build this thing. But I sort of lost the battle. My wife told me, you're going to make a fool of yourself if you quit deferring, quit saying you don't want it to happen. But I'm a leukemia survivor, so that's why they had the plan to the connection for them to name it for me. I don't know why they didn't find somebody else, but I was appreciative of the honor, and they do such good work. And people, I think about this with hospice care. There are people out there who really care about other human beings, mm-hmm. and they do things for them. And the Cancer Center over there, they really make people feel good. They've done fundraising, Athens Regional Foundation, Piedmont Regional Foundation now. They've done things to create living quarters. Family can't afford to be with their loved one. They're, first of all, hopeful for life, and then they want to be with them as they're convalescing. And they can't afford a hotel bill, so they've got it worked out now to where you pay a minimum, I'm sure just to do the basic utilities and changing of the bed clothes and washing the mm-hmm. sheets and those kinds of elementary things we all do or have done for us at home. So it's just been wonderful, and I'm overwhelmed that my name is on it, but I certainly don't deserve it. I am proud to be a cancer survivor, and proud of the things, the advances that are being made in medicine today. And some of the best advances with cancer is with the blood cancers. If you get a blood cancer, you have good opportunity to survive. Of course, a big thing, like it is all other illnesses, the early detection makes a big difference.
Yeah, well, I can understand the instinct to hide from recognition for that kind of thing, but that's a great testament to you, and you are such a goodwill ambassador for this region. I know that gives comfort to people who are there under vulnerable circumstances. So that's a great testament to you and your character.
You mentioned hospice care. Timely this week, President Jimmy Carter just entered hospice care. Do you have any relationship with him? Any past experiences with President Carter?
Well, when he ran for governor, I supported Carl Sanders, his opponent, because Carl was a quarterback at Georgia.
That's right.
He was a bulldog. He was a bulldog. Okay. But I admired President Carter, and I had a couple of trips down. I made a couple of trips down to Plains to hear him teach Sunday school. and he really knew the Bible. So I always thought perhaps that his good work with the peace treaty, when let's see, who were the prime ministers, Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat, when they when they
good memory, yeah, 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 that's course. Exactly what I was about to say.
Absolutely, it's on the tip of my tongue.
When they got together and had the Middle East peace accords, I just wondered if his knowledge of the Bible helped him any.
Yeah,
as he was trying to negotiate with those two guys, that was a marvelous thing. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, didn't he, for that?
Absolutely. Yes,
sir. And yes, sir. I've been around President Carter a little bit, but I didn't have a round of golf with him or anything like that. But I've read all of his books. He's a fine writer, very fine writer.
You know, he has excellent taste in women, too. And let me tell you the story behind this. This is my one Jimmy Carter story. I was at a fundraiser for Jason when he was running for governor. And all my Republican friends will be upset to hear that I was there. Now, I tried to hide from cameras, you know, so I
couldn't be. Yes, of course.
Of course, now I'm talking about it. But at the very – we were trying to sneak out early. We wanted to go to dinner, my wife and I. My wife's name is Kyle. And we're sneaking out. We're to the end of the driveway of this big fancy house in Buckhead. And then Hail to the Chief starts playing over the loudspeakers in the garden. And sure enough, Jimmy Carter comes out surrounded by Secret Service. And the first person he sees is my wife. And I don't know if he thought that it was my wife's house or what. You know, we weren't supposed to be at this part in the reception line. And she goes, you know, President Carter, hi, I'm Kyle Skates. He goes, oh, yes, you are very pretty. And then just like, just keeps walking on. And, you know, she's swooning over there. Yeah. And it's been her, she's trying to collect all the former presidents. Yes. That's the only one she has now. But
you know, he was a very, very passionate fly fisherman. And he fished up in North Georgia. He had a home up there. And I've seen some of the – there's a guy that fished with him, and I should remember his name, but I'm having problems. But he had a – he would build – you could build your own reel, bamboo reel. He had bamboo imported from China, the best bamboo there is, and President Carter had one of those. He went through the class like everybody else to build your own reel. Rod.
Fly rod. That's a great story by President Carter. I got one story like that about Coach Dooley. It's one of my favorites, and then we'll get into five to go. We were down at the Desire Cup, Danny Warfel's event around Georgia, Florida weekend. They raise a ton of money for Desire Street Ministries. It's Georgia versus Florida Ryder Cup-style golf tournament, and there's a big gala on Thursday night. Coach Spurrier shows up. Tim Tebow shows up. Coach Dooley's there. A bunch of Georgia guys are there. And Laura Rutledge, who's on ESPN now, she's on SEC Nation. She does NFL Live. She is the MC of the gala, and she's dressed up mighty nice, you know, black gown dress. And Coach Dooley and Coach Spurrier are sitting there with her as she's kind of starting this fireside chat. And Coach Dooley's sitting there in her chair, his chair, and she's sitting there in the middle, and she asks Coach Dooley this long-winded question to get started. And she's got these huge diamond earrings on. And she asks Coach Dooley this long-winded question, and in response to the question, Coach Dooley looks at her and goes, "Those earrings are beautiful." He was just and Barbara was sitting right there. I mean, that was hilarious. He didn't hear the question one bit.
Didn't hear a word you said.
Was.
But yes. Yes. Absolutely.
All right, Lauren, this has been an absolute blast. We could talk to you all day long. We have a parting segment called Five to Go. We're going to ask you five questions to get to know you a little bit better, and then we'll let you get out of here. The first question I have for you, we talked a lot about golf in this interview. Who's your dream golf foursome?
Well, Augusta, you can't beat, and I'm fortunate to played Cypress Point, Pebble Beach.
Okay. Who would you play with? Who would your foursome be at one of those courses if you could pick any three guys or girls?
Just exclude us. We know that.
Well, I wouldn't include Drew. I want to win.
There you go. Cosign.
It's hard to win. In the games I play, it's hard to win as a scratch golfer. I'll say that.
Figure something out.
You want the 14, that's me. You can shoot a 73 Absolutely. On any given day.
I don't know. I probably would like to play with some renowned folks. I don't know. I'd probably like to play with Billy Graham. Maybe he'd be one. Thought he was a great ambassador and an honest man. Maybe I wouldn't want to play with Donald Trump because he cheats.
That's what I've heard. He's a big-time cheater.
Jimmy Carter would be a good example.
Yeah,
I don't think he played golf, though.
No.
But I'd fly fish with him, and I don't know, Vern Luck.
There you go. Vern's a good guy.
Vern would be, we'd be laughing the whole round because Vern's such a great raconteur. So what is that? That's two. I got to have one more.
Throw Coach McGill in there. Did he play golf?
He didn't play golf. But
Arnold Palmer.
Oh, I'd like to play with Arnold.
That'd be good.
Arnold, I got to know Arnold, a great story. I called his man this Friday. Doc was his longtime press aide. Told him I was going to be in Orlando, and could I record my weekly radio show with him? He said, well, how long does it take? I said, well, it's an hour show, but I can do it in 30 minutes. He said, oh, no, that's too long. So 10 or 15 minutes. And I said, well, I'll take what I can get. But I knew if I went in his office and started recording him, he would not run me out.
Yeah.
So I stayed for an hour and a half.
That's awesome.
One of the questions I wanted to ask him, did he have any idea how many times he'd signed his name? And this was several years ago, so he said at the time his secretary had just retired in the last year, but she had estimated when she retired. Now, this doesn't count events and count, FBOs at an airport somewhere, but the people who requested his autograph, he had signed his name 4 million times.
Holy cow.
That's great.
And always very well written, too. Yes. That was a key for Arnold Palmer. Yeah, awesome.
Master of branding,
yes,
and licensing,
no doubt.
IMG was him.
What's the next five to go question for Lauren here?
All right, what's your favorite, your last meal? What restaurant are you going to? And it can't be something your wife makes. We don't want to hear about the chicken casserole from the Let the Big Dog Eat cookbook. We want to hear like a good.
Where's
restaurant.
That reservation going to be?
Well, in recent weeks, I had a steak at Slater's in Athens and Five Points, the best steak I've ever eaten in Athens.
Tonight, so, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, that could be a ringing endorsement for a new advertiser here on Punt and the Poor Man.
I was really thinking he was going to say, like, you know, Delmonico's or something, but now.
Nothing like a good steak with the best red wine.
Speaking our language. I love that. What's your favorite SEC road trip?
Oh, either or Vandy or Kentucky, but Kentucky has lost its luster now that we play so deep in the season. Mm-hmm. We don't have an opportunity to experience the Keeneland race course at full peak. But I'd probably say Vandy.
I'm going to push on that. What do you like to do? I don't like that road trip. I try to every year. What do you do? What makes it special for you?
Well, first of all, it's easy drive up 75. Then you can... And then go left in Chattanooga. So you can take friends with you. So I like that. And I like going backstage at the Grand Ole Opry.
Okay.
That's really a wonderful experience. And my good friend Bill Anderson has been on the Opry ever since he graduated from Georgia.
Whispering Bill.
And so I like that. And I like the fact that if you can play it at noon – you got a night.
Yeah.
You got two nights
of
doing whatever you want to do. And Nashville's a great town. It's become a great big league town, you know. They got
absolutely. I don't know if you've seen the plans for the new stadium, but
that's gonna
be mighty tempting for an SEC championship.
No
stadium.
Question and about it.
Contractually, I have to bring up any mention of Vanderbilt, Drew Butler's game-saving tackle in Nashville. The $1 million tackle.
The $2 million tackle.
What year
was that? That was 2011. Dean Leggy dubbed it the $2 million tackle because Coach Rick's buyout that year was $2 million. We had started the season 0-2. We had lost to Boise State in the Georgia Dome and then South Carolina at home. And then we won 10 games in a row and won the SEC East and lost to LSU in the SEC Championship game. But that was the game where James Franklin and Todd Grantham almost got into a fist fight at midfield. Jordan Rogers from The Bachelor, now on SEC Network, was the quarterback. Yeah, block punt.
Yeah.
And tackle.
You wouldn't have had to tackle. I know. You just kicked it away from him.
Yeah, if I would have just kicked it away. Absolutely. No doubt.
I'm going to have to remember that this fall. I'd forgotten that.
There you go. There you go. All right, last question, Lauren, then we'll get you out of here. What's the one app on your iPhone you can't live without? You're always on that iPhone. You text really well, too.
Three people have called while we
yes, I know.
Well, I'm not really good with technology, so I don't know what I don't know the apps on there. I can't do Uber. I know that.
Yeah.
So I'm a loser when it comes to technology.
You do a pretty good job. You got
I can type, and that's about it.
Was that four or five?
I don't know.
That, what, one more for good measure?
One more. Is that restaurant? Oh, I would. Band musical act. You can get to see one band. You have backstage passes and see somebody, and it can't be somebody you know. Again, Bill Anderson at the Ryan's probably pretty cool, but past or present.
Well, I don't know. I would have probably years ago chosen somebody with the Grand Ole Opry. I'm not into country music to where I have to have it playing all day, but I do enjoy it. I grew up on a farm in Middle Georgia listening to Eddie Arnold. So he had a great voice and just a great talent. But I probably would have chosen somebody, maybe the Sons of the Pioneers. That might have been a band I'd like to hear. I had a wonderful experience. I was helping Doug Sanders with his charity golf outing in Houston at one time, and he got Willie Nelson to come and play to the staff, just the volunteer workers.
Wow.
It wasn't a concert per se, but I learned something. Those guys enjoy music so much, if they do a concert, they're going to give you the full throat. Whatever they got in their repertoire, they're going to give you. They ain't going to give you, an hors d'oeuvre and leave.
Yeah.
So I sat maybe first down and a half on a trunk while Willie's performing, and I sat there all night listening to Willie Nelson.
That's awesome.
You were just listening. Nothing else was happening with you sitting on the trunk with Willie.
I didn't have anything between my fingers.
that doesn't mean much now. There's all kinds of ways. Anyway.
Absolutely. Well, Lauren, this has been an absolute treat. Thank you so much for your time. What a great way to kick off this interview series. Punt and the Poor Man with none other than Lauren Smith, an absolute University of Georgia legend. So thank you so much. I know our audience will very much appreciate this, and appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, go Dogs. So fun to talk to Lauren. I think you said it was like an oral history lesson. As I was walking him up here, we're at the Grady School of Journalism. I walked him up a shitload of stairs. I kind of felt bad. It's pretty hot outside today. Yeah. Lauren is, I think, 83 years old now. People recognize him in the hallways. I know that voice. Hey, that's Lauren Smith. I mean, these are students at UGA right now who know who Lauren is. It was cool to kind of see him be recognized just going about his day.
It was awesome stuff. And he is such a core part of the UGA culture.
Yeah.
I remember in high school, I was driving my wife around one Saturday. She wasn't my wife then. She was my girlfriend then. And I don't know where we were going, but we had on a Georgia football broadcast, and I didn't grow up a Georgia fan. She didn't either, but I was like, you have to listen to this. You know, there's this guy with this really gravelly voice, no nonsense, and then there's this other guy on the sideline who's a little more flighty and eccentric, talking about different things, and just their back and forth is so good.
The juxtaposition.
Oh, my gosh.
Phenomenal. And, all time.
He has done so many things and finds so many things interesting. And, there could be a crucial point in the game where he's thinking about something totally different than everybody else. And anyway, it was great to see some of that come out.
His story about sitting on the back of his tailgate listening to a private Willie Nelson concert was amazing. We could have talked to him forever. As soon as we got done, we went outside, and Charles Dean, the dean of the journalism school here at the University of Georgia, came to say hello to Lauren. He was like, Lauren, did you tell him about when you got to interview Ty Cobb? We were like, what? I mean, you and I thought about how many things we missed, even with all these notes. And Charles Dean said, this is literally the only guy. You're talking about the dean of a journalism school saying, this is the only person I know who has interviewed somebody who was born in the 1800s, Ty Cobb, born in the 1900s, countless people, and born in the 2000s, the current players at the University of Georgia. So remarkable career that he's had, and man, he's still going as strong as ever.
Gosh, you know, the dean of the Grady School of Journalism giving us praise for our first show.
Hey.
Gosh, can you say Peabody? Yeah. Can you hear it?
I can.
They make them right here.
Yeah, they do. We should get in line for a Peabody. We'll stand in line. We'll see if they let
us
in. Absolutely.
Move over Tina Fey. Drew Butler is here.
And Liam Brantley, producer of the year. Liam Brantley. That was a blast, though. Big thanks to Lauren for spending some time with us. Maybe we'll have him on again in the future. But we're off to a fast start. Punt and the poor man. Ryan, grade me. How was it? What'd you think?
Oh, I mean, you know, it was a solid C.
Okay.
C plus.
C's get degrees. Yeah. We'll take that. Thank you very much. And thank you for tuning in to Punt and the Poor Man. We'll talk to you next week. See you.